This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we hear about an upcoming performance by the New Britain Symphony Orchestra. The composer of Are There Still Bells has an amazing story. We'll hear about him later in the hour. But first...
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road.
We know winter's coming. The last thing you may be thinking about is a road trip, but today, where we live, we're taking you there anyway. Architectural historian Richard Longstreth describes the road trip as an American institution. In fact, he wrote a book all about it, and it's the inspiration for a new exhibit at the New Haven Museum. Road Trip opens next Tuesday. The exhibition explores America's love for travel by car and celebrates the creativity of roadside architecture. What landmarks or souvenirs help make your last road trip memorable? We want to hear from you. 860-275-7266. You can email where we live at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome in studio Mary Donahue. She's an architectural historian, a roadside enthusiast, and assistant publisher of Connecticut Explored. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Lucy.
And on the phone with us is Richard Longstreth, also an architectural historian and professor at George Washington University. He's the author of several books, including The American Department Store Transformed, 1920 to 1960, and Road Trip, Roadside America from Custard's Last Stand to the Wigwam Restaurant. Richard, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
I want to start with Mary. Tell us about the New Haven Museum and what its role is in the community.
The New Haven Museum is a wonderful institution right on Whitney Avenue, close to Yale, close to the Peabody Museum, and their role is really to tell the story of all things New Haven.
And so it was founded a long time ago, right?
It was founded. It's over 100 years old. It is in a beautiful 1914 neoclassical building, and you would think from the outside that maybe it's very sedate, but then you go inside the museum and you realize there are activities for children. Every exhibit is fun and informative and just a visual feast.
So I mentioned Road Trip. Tell us about it. What inspired this new exhibition? I understand you're the guest curator.
Our executive director, Margaret Takachewski, she came up with the idea for Road Trip because not only is she a Road Trip fan, but it's the 50th anniversary of the National Historic Preservation Act, which really created the framework to help Americans protect and preserve their historic buildings. It came about during the era of the interstate highway and urban renewal, where cherished landmarks were being knocked down by the hundreds, if not thousands. And so it's the 50th anniversary, and there's no better place than New Haven to celebrate historic architecture. She also wanted to capture the excitement in Richard Longstreth's new book called Road Trip, which is a collection of fabulous photographs, and thought this could be a marriage right there.
And Richard, again, is on the line with us. Tell us about your book. I understand it's about roadside architecture. When we say that, what are we talking about, Richard?
Well, these were photographs taken mainly in the 1970s when I seem to have had more time on my hands than I do now, and also had any number of reasons to travel across country, north, south, east, and west, throughout that decade. It had to do with places of employment and other things I was researching. And I can't really tell you how I got interested in all of this, but I did, and spent a lot of time trying to capture a landscape that was rapidly vanishing with the interstate highway system. The old two-lane and unlimited access four-lane highways were either being completely replaced or were being rendered redundant for long-distance travel. And with that went a whole array of mainly independently owned businesses that were catering to motorists for gasoline, for food, for overnight accommodation, sometimes for recreation, especially oriented to children, and most of which didn't lie convenient to interstate highway interchanges, and were soon going to disappear in one way or another, and this was a became a real interest of mine to try and document this quickly disappearing landscape as much as time permitted.
So you're talking about motels, diners, gas stations?
Yes, exactly. And it was also really at a time when chain operations were becoming much more frequent than they had been in the 1950s or early 1960s. Chain operations, well, of course, they had been for some things like Howard Johnson's restaurants. By and large, these were independently owned enterprises. I photographed a number of chains, too, and franchise outlets for food. So I was documenting some fairly recent stuff, most of which has long since disappeared, too, franchises that you've never heard of today that had a relatively short life, and, of course, a few others like McDonald's, which have stayed around.
Now, Mary mentioned it's the 50th anniversary of the National Historic Preservation Act. When we talk about motels and diners, maybe gas stations we've seen along highways, you know, that might make some people pause and say, well, why would you want to preserve those? What would you tell them?
Well, I did not think in terms of preservation, really, because the nature of roadside development still is today ephemeral. You look at any major freeway exit, and with lots of these establishments that are clustered around it, in 15 years, that's going to look very different. And many of those buildings would have been modified, many others replaced. So that the commercial strip is, by its very nature, ephemeral. I think the shift from the old U.S. highway system that had been put in place beginning in the 1920s and the interstate highway system constructed largely in the late 50s and 1960s, early 70s, accelerated that process of change. And since that time, there have been some places that have been preserved, some stretches of highway that have been preserved. What used to be U.S. 66 in Albuquerque is a good example of that. And there are a few motels that date from the 1940s, let us say, that have been preserved and have a boutique trade, which is all wonderful. But the idea of trying to preserve this sort of work on a large scale, it never entered my mind because there are too many forces working against that sort of effort. But at least they could be captured in photographs.
So take us into your book, Richard. What are some of the places that you chronicled back in the 1970s that may still be around?
That may still be around. I'm not sure.
Is that wishful thinking?
It's because I haven't done any sort of systematic revisiting of these things. Occasionally, I'll be on an old highway and see something that I remember from 40-odd years ago. But I would say that probably the great majority of buildings that I captured back then have burned down. Some have are still standing, but have been modified, perhaps beyond recognition. A few others may stand more or less intact, but I think they're a very small portion of what I was looking at.
So any unique ones that come to mind from your book that you'd like to talk about?
Well, there was one of the things that fascinated people back in the mid-20th century and still do today are buildings that are mimetic, that is, that look or try and look like and allude to other things. There was a ship hotel and restaurant along U.S. 30 in the mountains of western Pennsylvania, which was really quite extraordinary and built during in a couple of stages during the 1930s. I saw it in a day that was overcast and misty, and I think it's in the exhibition. It has quite a bit of atmosphere, but it was still a going operation, and about 5 years after, this would have been 1971, I guess, when I saw it, and not too many years later, it burned down, which was rather sad. But there are all sorts of buildings that didn't necessarily the motels. A lot of the motels in the exhibition were quite old when I took them, and my wife and I wouldn't necessarily stay in fascinating to see as remnants from as early as the 1930s.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm speaking with Richard Longstreth. He's an architectural historian and professor at George Washington University, author of many books, including Road Trip, the inspiration behind a new exhibit at New Haven Museum. Mary Donahue is here. Tell us about some of the images from Richard's book that helped inspire the images that are shown in this exhibition opening next week.
Well, Richard was gracious enough to send us about 130 images, slide images, primarily from the East Coast, because we thought that'll resonate with New Haveners who went out to places all up and down the coast from Maine to Washington, D.C., or all the way down to Florida. So we had a wonderful array to choose from. We were using about a dozen, and they primarily fall in the categories of, you know, the triangle of roadside architecture is diners, gas stations, and motels. So we've used illustrations from Richard's book as an anchor in those areas, and we've really chosen some fun ones that we think will resonate with Connecticut residents. So we have a wonderful streamlined diner, for example, and there are over 50 of those in Connecticut. Everybody has their favorite. We used a Carvel ice cream stand because that was founded right over the line in New York from Connecticut. And then we also used an iconic image from the Jim Crow era of abandoned tourist cabins that still have a neon sign that says colored out in front of it.
And we're going to talk more about that after the break. There was one picture, again, very lovely pictures that are in Richard's book. It really takes you back to the era when he was traveling the open road taking these pictures. But there was the milk can image from North Smithfield, Rhode Island. Did that make the exhibition?
The milk can did make the exhibition. And that is one of those mnemonic buildings that's meant to look like what service they're going to provide you. And that's still standing. It's been listed on the National Register of Historic Places. It's been documented by the Historic American Building Survey. So preservationists take these buildings very seriously. When Richard was out there photographing them as a scholar and a PhD student, they were not taken seriously or considered worthy of study. But now the National Register lists buildings over 50 years old. They're all in that category. They represent buildings that everyday Americans would have encountered in their travels and really hold as dear landmarks. So the milk can definitely did make it. That was actually an ice cream stand.
And we're going to hear more about the exhibition again coming up. I want to thank Richard Longstreth. He's an architectural historian, again, professor at George Washington University, author of Road Trip, Roadside America, From Custard's Last Stand to the Wigwam Restaurant. Richard, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And we do have an image of the milk can, again, found in North Smithfield, Rhode Island, on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. When we come back, we'll hear more about the exhibit and find out a little bit more about some of the other souvenirs that are part of Road Trip at the New Haven Museum. Don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more. What you say? This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil.
Very often we go from New Haven to Hammonasset for a day in the summer, and we would make an annual pilgrimage from New Haven to Hartford to do our Christmas shopping at G. Fox Company. Oh, I mean, we'd get in the car and drive up Route 5 to Vermont or out, you know, to the Cape.
First of all, I want to say that we are tireless road trippers. We always insist on taking family trips in the car. The few times we've taken trips in the plane, we feel like it takes just as long, if not longer, and there are delays, and you don't have the opportunity to get off and stumble upon things and you know, just find the unexpected.
It wasn't uncommon for us to go to Cape Cod, to Cooperstown, New York, to the Baseball Hall of Fame, to Lake George, to go up to Santa's Village in Vermont to see Old Man in the mountain in New Hampshire. I'll go to York, Maine, and rent a cottage and get in that icy cold waters. So we traveled through much of the Northeast, and we like to take the blue highways, the back roads especially, not just the main interstates. We didn't have to get there on deadline.
And those were voices from a video put together for Road Trip. It's a new exhibit which opens to the public next Tuesday, November 22nd, at the New Haven Museum in Connecticut. If you have a memorable road trip that you want to share, 860-275-7266. I'm joined in studio by Mary Donahue, an architectural historian, roadside enthusiast, and assistant publisher of Connecticut Explored, the guest curator for Road Trip exhibit. And joining us now is Dave Corrigan, museum curator of the Museum of Connecticut History at the Connecticut State Library here in Hartford. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Mary, to go back to the exhibit that's opening next week, you crowdsourced items for this exhibition. Tell us how you went about doing that and what kind of response did you get?
Crowdsourced is the fancy new term for museums to reach out to the community and really get those stories and artifacts and remembrances and mementos that they can share with us and share with the larger community. So we held a couple of collection days at the museum. We invited anybody who had a souvenir they wanted to share or a trip they wanted to share to come down and be videotaped or loan us their memento. We also did one at the Ethnic Center, so we were happy to work with the Irish American Historical Society, the African American Historical Society, the Jewish American Historical Society in New Haven. That all helped us kind of develop a picture of where New Haveners went and what kind of adventure and impact that had on them and what they brought back.
So tell us about some of those items.
Some of those items, boy, they range from, we are the ages of the people that we interviewed that or brought us things range from 16 to 91. So the 16-year-old brought us a hand-drawn map. When he was 12, his mother and his brother and himself went on a cross-country trip, and instead of using his GPS on his phone at that point, he had a big hand-drawn map.
Like, a map? What's that?
I know. Paper. What's that? And so he marked their proposed route in blue and the route that they actually took in red, and it was an eye-opening experience to him to actually have to plan a trip, to figure out how many miles in between, to connect the dots between we're staying with Aunt Dorothy here and we're staying with somebody else related to us there. And it had a huge impact on him and his brother. And his brother actually, who I think was 8 at the time, after they visited Silicon Valley, he decided he was going to develop the next Google and be an app developer. But at any rate, and then some of the things that were brought back are we have a whole array of wonderful children's toys. And I know children usually focus on picking out one special thing that they then drag around for the whole trip. So we have banks and charm bracelets and toy trucks. We also have a section called Are We There Yet?, which includes all of our guidebooks, tour books, brochures, AAA books, holding maps. And there's two kinds of people. There's people like my mom who threw that stuff out the day after the trip. But then there's other people who have hung on to those souvenirs going back to the 40s all these years and were able to pull them out for us.
You know, I think I have some dusty maps myself in the trunk of my car. I wanted to turn to Dave. So you're with the Museum of Connecticut History. Tell us about that for residents who may not have ever visited.
Unfortunately, there's probably quite a few out there. We are part of the Connecticut State Library. Our main focus is on Connecticut military, industrial, and political history. We have permanent exhibits. We have the governor's portrait collection. We have the Colt firearms collection. And Mary called me earlier this year and said they were going to do this road trip exhibition at New Haven. And did I have anything that might be appropriate? So I started looking at our industrial collection with a little bit different light, not just as products of manufacturing and companies, but how did this relate to a road trip? And some of the obvious examples that came to mind were products from the American Thermos Company in Norwich, the iconic Scotch plaid coolers, of which I have yet to acquire one. But we have other pieces in the collection that were definitely related, picnic jugs and thermoses, and we've collected advertisements over the years relating to all these different products. So we've loaned a few advertisements for thermos products, one touting Christmas gifts of thermos products, which include some of the items that we've actually loaned to the exhibit. We've also been collecting more recently postcards of motels in Connecticut, roadside restaurants and gas stations, and Mary borrowed several of those that have, I think, the Clam Box restaurants. I don't know if they're still around or not. But they featured postcards with maps so that you could find your way from Greenwich to Rhode Island using one of these maps and stopping at Clam Box restaurants all along the way. But there were a few tour guides from the AAA that we've collected. Several souvenir plates that were very popular in the, I guess, mostly in the 70s and 80s, maybe not so much today.
So what are those when you say souvenir plates?
They're regular ceramic plates. They have usually Connecticut in the, big letters in the center, and they're surrounded with vignettes from various sites and locations around the state. The great one in the show has at the very top of the plate is a great image of the West Rock Tunnel on the Merritt Parkway. And that's surrounded by, I think there's a picture of a submarine from New London. There's a hat labeled in Danbury, which brings to mind the once famous Danbury hat industry. Harkness Tower from Yale was always popular. Mystic Seaport, the Mark Twain House. So they were places that people could visit or had visited on their trip and could pick up this plate as a souvenir.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm talking with Dave Corrigan, Museum Curator of the Museum of Connecticut History at the Connecticut State Library, and Mary Donahue. She's an architectural historian and assistant publisher of Connecticut Explored, also guest curator of Road Trip, an exhibit opening next week at the New Haven Museum. You know, Dave, as I was hearing you explain some of these items, it sounds like the items we might have in our attic or maybe in a box in the basement, why is it so important, maybe this is a question for you too, Mary, to pull them out and to think about, the story behind these items?
The story behind these items can tell you a lot about your experiences, poignant pieces in your parts of your life, time you spent with your family. We had one interviewee who's probably maybe about 40 say that one time he and his wife took their kids on a trip to either Florida or Georgia. And they realized at one point they had spent 8 hours in the car together without the radio on talking. And those kinds of memories that people have and the kind of family exchanges that they had and then the funny stories that come out of those trips really give you a grounded sense of who you are. And this exhibit was unusual for the New Haven Museum because usually the New Haven Museum concentrates on things that happened literally within the city limits of New Haven. But this is about how travel affected New Haveners as from the Depression till now and how they went out, whether it was a day trip to Savin Rock, whether it was up to Hammonasset, or whether it was a 2-week vacation trip, how that affected them, and how they brought those experiences back to New Haven.
Earlier in the show, we heard from photographer Richard Longstreth, whose book Road Trip helped inspire parts of this Road Trip exhibit. And you mentioned this photo that shows these abandoned tourist cabins that have the sign that reads colored. Travel at a certain time in our country was very difficult, maybe dangerous for African Americans. So you made a point to pull out that photograph. Tell us why.
We did. That photograph by itself, you might see it and you might find it really jarring or somehow just put you off. But the story behind the Green Book was an inspiring one. And the Green Book was started in 1936 by a postman, mail carrier in New York City who was African American. And his goal was to document places in New York City that would serve African Americans. You weren't always guaranteed of any kind of service, and in fact, some places could be threatening. After the first year, it was so wildly popular, he expanded it nationwide, and it became known as the Green Book. It was the Negro's Traveler's Motorist Guide. It listed everything that you need on a trip. It listed barbershops, beauty salons, private homes, tourist homes, motels, restaurants, nightclubs, anything that you might need, and it provided African Americans a handbook as to where they could stop and expect services and be safe as they traveled, which is a very different experience probably than a lot of white travelers in the 50s and 60s in the sort of heyday of those big road trips before the airline industry took off. it was a very different experience for Black travelers. And the motto on the front of the Green Book is take the Green Book with you. You'll never know when you'll need it.
I understand there are a lot of locations in New Haven that were in this Green Book. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. At first, you'd think, oh, well, Jim Crow, that's just a Southern thing. We didn't have to worry about that. But no, this book covered all 48 continental states, and Connecticut turns up early in the listings. The New York Public Library has digitized all of them, so you can see them online. And you'll see that Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven have these sites listed from day one. And so when we looked at those, we chose the 1947 issue to look at. There were about a dozen New Haven sites. Four of those buildings still stand. And the one we chose to highlight is the Monterey Club, which is a building still there on Dixwell Avenue, which served a nationally known and internationally known jazz community and had wonderful greats like Billie Holiday come to town. And they really couldn't stay in downtown New Haven. So they needed the Green Book, and the Green Book provided a list of all the places and services that they would need when they came to New Haven to perform at the Monterey Club.
And you mentioned earlier that you had reached out to a lot of different communities from diverse backgrounds, crowdsourcing to get items, and you reached out to the Jewish community. What did they provide?
The Jewish community, we worked with their archivist, Marv Barger, and he's 91, and he had an interesting interview because he talks about places that Jewish New Haveners went during the Depression in the 1940s. There were places that would not serve Jewish travelers either. He talks about going to a section of Milford called Woodmont that was affectionately and not so affectionately known as Bagel Beach, because about 95% of the people that rented cottages there were Jewish, because they would rent to Jews. So they had a summer synagogue there. But he also was interesting because he's gone to both of the New York World's Fair. He went to the 1938 New York World's Fair from Connecticut as a child, and then he took his own children to the 1964 World's Fair.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about road trip, and I was curious, Dave Corrigan, you helped contribute some items. Any personal items that you brought forth for this exhibit?
Yes, there was a metal thermos jug made in Norwich by the thermos company that my family owned and used in the 50s when we would be herded into the car and driven from New Haven to Hammonasset quite a few Sundays in the summer. It sat in my parents' garage for years, and when we cleaned out the house, I looked at that and I said, well, I think that's museum worthy. So we added it to the collection with a number of other things from the house. But it just brings back painful memories. Sitting on the beach in Hammonasset and, you know, getting a sunburn, pre-sunblock days in the 50s. And my mother would use some kind of a suntan lotion called Skoll. I think it was supposed to, you know, it was the big deal. It was Danish, so it was probably very good. And you might as well have rubbed Wesson oil on us. It was just, you know, we just fried. So I'd come home from the beach and, you know, maybe by the next Sunday I'd be over the sunburn, and then we'd go back. So it was kind of a never-ending cycle of, you know, burn and peel.
And Mary, guest curator of a road trip at the New Haven Museum, any road trip stories that you want to share?
Oh, gosh. This has fascinated me for years, and I've written extensively in Connecticut Explored magazine about it. I did a long piece on the Berlin Turnpike, for example. I've done one on food shacks that are architecturally significant, like Blackie's in Cheshire for the magazine. But when Margaret Ann called me about this project, I didn't want to tell her, but I probably would have done it for nothing, and because it's so exciting. And I brought about 100 postcards that I'd already collected of Connecticut roadside architecture into the project and into the museum, and some of those are being used in the exhibit. So that was really fun.
you know, when we talk about items from the past, you know, it's something that, you know, older generations tend to do more. I mean, do you think this exhibition will bring out, you know, young people in Connecticut to see, you know, about souvenirs and landmarks from the past?
I hope so, because I think there's so much fun to be had out there on the two lane highways. My husband and I took our two millennials with us to Chicago. We drove from Connecticut to Chicago 2 years ago. So they were 24 and 26. And they were wonderful because we used all their modern apps on their phones. So they have the app that tells you where's the nearest gas station. But they have all the apps, too, that will tell you where to find local road food. So every time we got off the highway, we made sure we found a local place to eat. And so they're on their phones in the back seat debating the various virtues of barbecue places, for example. And so instead of just being glued to their phone and not looking out the window, we tried to incorporate those modern conveniences and phone apps into our travels, and we just had a great time.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're hearing about Road Trip. It's going to be an exhibit opening next week at the New Haven Museum. I understand there's a party that's going to preview the exhibit, Mary?
There's a wonderful party tomorrow night called Road Trip Revelry, and it's going to have music, food. It's going to have fun. It starts, members of the New Haven Museum can come between 5 and 6. The party is from 6 to 8:30. You can get your tickets for the event at the newhavenmuseum.org or at the museum. We're going to have a local DJ spin classic road trip vinyl, and we're going to have diner-inspired appetizers, drinks, and treats by Spice Catering Group. We have Ray Anderson, who's a wonderful local radio host, who's going to do travel trivia and car games all night. So we're hoping you'll come out and join us tomorrow night, get a sneak peek at the exhibit. Richard Longstreth will be there for the evening, so it'll be fun.
I want to thank Mary Donahue, architectural historian, roadside enthusiast, assistant publisher of Connecticut Explored, guest curator for Road Trip at the New Haven Museum. Thank you so much for coming in.
We're thrilled. Thank you so much, Lucy.
And Dave Corrigan, museum curator of the Museum of Connecticut History at the Connecticut State Library. Thanks again, Dave.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, we introduce you to a Hartford man who has a unique story about his life and his passion, music. This is Where We Live.
Seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again. Like a band of gypsies, we go down the highway. We're the best of friends, insisting that the world keep turning our way. And our way is on the road again.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up Monday, the Thanksgiving holiday is just around the corner, a time for food and festivities, but it can be an especially difficult time of year for those of us who've lost a spouse or another loved one. On the next Where We Live, we'll take a special look at loss, grief, and widowhood, and we'll dig into what it means to be a young widow or widower grappling with a new chapter of life. That's on Monday. And now we want to introduce you to a remarkable man. Hartford resident Albert Hurwit made a living as a doctor, but music played a special part in his life. The retired radiologist took that love and did something many in the music world found surprising. Albert Hurwit is a Hartford resident and national award-winning composer. Welcome to Where We Live.
Well, pleasure to be here.
And I understand I can call you Albie?
Please do.
So you're not the typical composer. Tell us about your background.
There's just about no musical background, save for three and a half years as a piano student when I was a young kid. And I was at best an average piano student. I didn't like to practice, and I had a good ear, and I kind of bluffed my way through. And that's my total musical background. I've never studied theory or harmony, and so my route is totally different in composing as every other composer.
But you had a passion for music. Where did that come from?
It possibly related to the fact when I was 10 or 11 years old, my father had a hardware furniture store combined on Park Street. And on weekend, on Saturdays and holidays, he'd on occasion ask me to come in and push the merchandise around. And he would pay me minimal wage. One day, somebody came in with some classical records, the old 78 RPMs. And I asked on a lark if I could just take one of these home. And I believe it was a Beethoven symphony. I still have them up in my attic. And I played it. And for the next few years, I was entranced. And every time I'd work, I'd have a Tchaikovsky or a Beethoven symphony home with me. But then, as a teenager, you know, girls and games came into the picture, and that was it for music.
So you had a passion and an interest, but eventually you became a doctor. Tell us about that path.
Well, I was admitted to college, to Harvard College, and I wanted to major in music. And I went for an interview, and the professor said, well, play a little something, and I did, because I had done some composing. And my way of inscribing it was simply with numbers, because I still don't read notes very well today. So I played a piece, and he said, that's not bad. I'd like you in the department. I said, fine. He said, wait a minute. You have to pass a sight reading test. And I knew if it had many sharps or flats or if I didn't know the tune, I was out. And I was out. And so he said, look, I really would like you to come in the department. Take piano lessons for a year, and then you'll spend your next 3 years. And so I became a doctor instead.
Were your parents happy about that path that you chose?
Yes. My mother died, so she obviously didn't know about it. But I think that my father was, yes.
I understand you wrote your first composition after your mother passed away?
Well, actually, I had been writing before she passed away. And there's one melody that I composed, and through the years it's really stuck with me. I mean, I'm talking when I was 15 or 16. It stuck with me, and I got married, had children, and I would play it for them, and they would. It was probably about the time my mother was ill, but I'm not sure of the inspiration of it. So I would play it to my children and, and now grandchildren. It's been kind of a family song when they come home, as they will this Thanksgiving. I'm sure they'll ask me to play it, particularly now that I've said this on the radio. And but it's become part of the symphony I wrote. It's a four-movement symphony, and it's 59 minutes long, about the immigration experience, my family's persecution, separation, and then coming to America. And the fourth movement, fourth movement starts with the family coming over the ocean, Ellis Island, and settling here. And the music changes, but on purpose, I wanted it to encompass the old world themes that I had created. And as I was doing it, there was something empty sounding, and I had worked with Michael Lancaster, the former musical director, conductor of the Hartford Symphony, and he would come in on occasion and advise me and tell me what key I was in and put in those nice Italian words, which I have no idea what they mean. But at this point, he said, you know, I know what's troubling you. You need a theme to encompass all these old world themes. So for 2 weeks, I kept trying, and then it hit me. And it's this tune that I composed when I was 15 years. And it's right in the middle of it, trying to encompass those old world themes. So it must have been percolating there for 60 years or so.
So we heard you, Albie, say that you know, you weren't able to read music, but you wanted to write and compose a symphony. So you had some help. But tell us about the process. How did you go about doing that?
Well, I loved my medical practice and did not want to retire. But music started to pour into my head when I was about 50. And at the age of 55, I decided, well, maybe I should do this. And so I went to the head of composition at the Hart School, and the professor there said, well, you know, just play something. And I did, and he put it on a synthesizer, which was one of the earliest synthesizers, and played it back. And he said, I think you should seriously consider being a composer. I said, what's entailed? Well, you have to take piano lessons for a year, undergraduate 4 years, postgraduate for what you want to do. And I'd been through this once in my life, and at that age was not about to do it again. And he said, there is an alternative way. You can learn computer software programs and compose without knowing the rules. And that's what I did.
So I understand you're able to write the symphony, compose it with the help of these computer software program and your friend Michael Lancaster. I wanted to hear a little bit of the third movement. It's called Remembrance. Let's hear it. That's from Remembrance. It's the award-winning third movement of Albie Hurwitz Symphony No. 1. And Albie, we invited you here today because we understand the movement's going to be performed Sunday, November 20th as part of the New Britain Symphony Orchestra's concert to freedom. And we're going to have details about that concert on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. So when we listen to that, do we hear that melody that you mentioned?
No.
So tell us, how did you get to this point?
Well, this melody... the third movement of the symphony, very briefly, family was persecuted, traveling across Europe from west to east to escape persecution. They finally landed in Russia and in around 1800, and for many decades, it was a poor farming village, but they got by. The mid-late 1800s, the Cossacks... the pogroms, and I remember my aunt telling me how she would take my mother's hand and they'd run up into the attic as the Cossacks on horseback would ride through the town, slashing their sabers at people. And at that point, the elders of the family told the youngers, my grandfather, my mother was an infant then, but her older siblings, that they must separate and go to the United States for freedom. And in doing so, they knew they would never see each other again. And I took that to heart and sat in my studio and said, well, how would I feel if I had to tell my three married children and six grandchildren, you must leave and we'll never see each other again? And that helped me inspire this, I think, sad movement. But in it, I also put that there might be a little hope in the future, and the hope certainly has been realized.
Mm-hmm. That story of how your family came to this country, it gets played over and over again in many different countries and situations. When people hear Remembrance, what do you want them to take away?
Well, you've hit it. This is, unfortunately, this is history. Many ethnic group, religions groups have suffered this, and it's happening today. We read in the newspapers people trying to cross the Mediterranean to get freedom in Europe. And it's a universal thing, and it's just become part of my work.
We have another clip from an earlier performance you also composed, Are There Still Bells? Let's hear a little bit of that. Albie Hurwitz, tell us about Are There Still Bells?
Are There Still Bells started because I'm undisciplined. Once in a while, to keep my act together, I will apply for a musical award. The reason being, There's a deadline. And so a couple times a year. And I sent in, I saw a competition, and it says for a French horn and chorus. Had to be only 3 minutes long, and it had to do with the Christmas season, and there was a deadline. So I either had to write my lyrics or get them from an old poem. And so I pulled out a book that I got, that I was given when I was bar mitzvah, when I was 13, of popular quotations put in Christmas time. And there I saw the words, "I heard the bells at Christmas time," which I now know, but I didn't know then and during the composition process, is a Christmas carol. I didn't know that then. But so I said, okay, I'll take the first three stanzas, and it's like 3 minutes, and I can do it. And I used those words, and I submitted it, and I didn't win any prize. I didn't even qualify for the booby prize. And I was then throwing away the materials, and it's based on a Longfellow poem, of which I took a small segment. And in reading the whole poem, the middle verses are very anti-war, very angry, ugly verses. And the reason is he was nursing his son back, who had been severely injured in the Civil War, and his wife had died a year earlier. Well, I realized I could take my pretty little tune and totally distort it to reflect that and then come back, yes, there is a God, peace on earth, goodwill to men, and decided to expand it. I did it was performed a Silent Hill Congregational Church a few years ago in a shorter version. The present version is 11 minutes, and it's turned into a not only Christmas carol, but now Peace on Earth, Goodwill to Men is written in Arabic, Hebrew, and different languages to come back to your point, that there is universal suffering with these type of persecutions, and this is a plea for world peace, and it ends, peace on earth, goodwill to all.
Albie Hurwit, it's been really a pleasure to talk with you. We just have a couple of minutes. You know, you'd mentioned that you were never trained in classical music, but you've been able to compose symphonies that orchestras have performed. How do you feel about that?
Absolutely wonderful.
The New Britain Symphony Orchestra will perform its concert to freedom this Sunday, November 20th at 3 p.m. at Central Connecticut State University, New Britain. More info on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. We're going to hear a little bit more of Remembrance. And Albie Hurwit, a Hartford resident, national award-winning composer, thank you so much for coming in.
It's been my pleasure.
You've reminded us it's never too late to follow our passion.
That's right.